Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dandy.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always, you know, I really like our intro music.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And one of the reasons I really like it is because it's really long and it irritates Lynn Woolley.
Well,
he writes me once a quarter and says your intro music is too long.
Yeah, we really like Lynn Woolley, so please don't get us wrong there.
But we enjoy irritating. Yeah. He enjoys irritating
me
too.
Yes, he does. It's like brothers; they poke each other. It's like just poke.
Lynn and I, every once in a while, typically about once a year, agree on something. And it's become sort of a tradition.
It's like a ground-shaking moment where the whole universe shifts a little bit, and you look at each other and you go, "Well, actually, we agree about that?"
This is really we actually do it in print normally, but it's one of those things where we really don't know how to relate to each other when we agree.
Well, let's argue about it anyway.
We can usually find something to argue about, but anyway. You are listening to you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And I got some good news.
Oh, you're going to cause people to stop listening. They don't listen for the good news.
The headline in the Wall Street Journal, September 9th, 2013, at 3:23 p.m. ET.
That sounds so futuristic. I mean, 2013. We'll just wait till the year is 2013.
How about ET?
Oh, yes.
It's ET.
Eastern time?
Right.
It's just, okay. All right. So what is the good news?
Americans' credit card debt declines.
We've been talking about that for months and months and months.
I mean, it's still pretty cool, though. I mean, actually, what happened is... the change from a year earlier is the money owed on credit cards fell by $1.84 billion.
Oh, well, that was probably all me.
Yeah, at a 2.6% annual rate in July from a month earlier. In June, the credit card debt of Americans dropped by 5.2%. So
we're paying off our debts, folks. That's good news.
That is, but we're now increasing our non-revolving debt, which is we're buying automobiles and so on.
Yeah.
So the reason I want to mention that is there's another thing that that came out at the same time, and I realize these are, you know, the fact that everybody's in debt up to their eyeballs and they're getting deeper in debt and the world's going to end and everything is terrible. I'm going to focus now. Jake can focus on something else, and that way we'll confuse everybody. But I kind of want to focus this hour on something that is a reality. And the reality is things are getting better.
Yes.
And they're getting better pretty fast. But there's better money to be made by telling you things are getting worse.
Well, especially if you make your money by selling the time on your eyeballs.
It's
a lot easier to get you to read or listen to bad news.
You
because
have time on your eyeballs?
Yes, it's a monetized commodity.
Got it.
Eyeball time. And see, I realize that there's a great deal of really good words to describe that.
Yes.
They make them sound very technical and they
clicks.
It's like clicks or it's eyeball time.
Really?
Yeah, and I know most people cannot see anything on their eyeball unless they look very good.
In the mirror.
But time on your eyeball, it exists, and it's worth money.
I think we should do a study on this.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Well, here is the headlines. This is from the Wall Street Journal, U.S. News, September 12th, 2013, to 11 p.m. ET. I love the fact that we don't just have the date anymore, we have the time.
Right. Well, that's the news that we live in, the news world that we live in today.
This is the headline. Budget deficit on track for smallest shortfall since 2008. I know that's disgusting.
That is pretty amazing. And we're talking about the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. And this gets better. The Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Management of Budget and the Treasury, which is scary when they all agree, are forecasting that in September... the United States government will run a surplus.
That is pretty awesome.
We actually did it in June, too.
The extraordinary measures that have been used by the Treasury Department to keep us below the debt ceiling. They're doing things like not funding federal pensions.
Well, picky.
Basically, they're putting it off until later in the year to fund these pensions, because right now they would have to borrow money to fund the pension, and they can't do that.
I don't know. A lot of you probably remember. I don't know if you keep up with the exact numbers, but our deficit at one point was running about, what was it, $1.4, $1.6 vicinity trillion dollars.
Yeah.
It is now, right now, the Congressional Budget Office is projecting for this fiscal year, which, by the way, ends at the end of this month.
Okay, October 1st is the new one.
That we will have a deficit for the total year of $680 billion. Now,
that's $1 trillion less than we did last year.
Well, actually, 2 years ago.
2 years ago. Yes.
But so the and it's still higher than most of us would like, certainly. But there is a lot of evidence coming in.
Well, it is that, got to throw this in there.
What's that?
TARP's profits. And the profits from the Federal Reserve bond purchasing programs, commonly referred to by letter number sequences of QE 1, 2, and 3, have provided about $800 billion in profits to the United States government.
And in fiscal year 2009, I've got it right here, we actually had a $1.4 trillion deficit. And so we are now down to...
That was 2009?
That was 2009. So in 2013, which is the year we're in right now, and I know that sounds redundant that I say that we're in... Actually, 2014 starts for the government, which is weird, but that's okay. Fiscal year 2014 starts next month.
Yes.
Which is why I think the automobile manufacturers come out with new cars at that point, but that's beside the point. It is probably wrong. But the point I want to make is that we have cut the deficit in half from 2009 to 2013. In 4 years, we've cut the deficit in half. Now, will this continue at about the same pace? And the evidence suggests, and again, all we can do about this is suggest, looking at what's going on, somewhere around 2016, 2017... the employment rates are likely to get up. There's several indicators out there, and I'm not going to go into the technical details here, but there are several indicators that are pretty good employment forecasters, and they basically says, what are your long-term projects? How many people do you think you will hire when they do surveys at businesses that are funding long-term projects, long-term growth plans? Presuming something really weird doesn't happen, somewhere around 2016, 2017, we will have employment rates up to normal levels in the United States, to normal historical levels, which dramatically increases tax revenues. And unless we come up with some massive new spending someplace that is unlikely to happen, we are probably going to be looking at starting to pay down the debt, and we're going to be faced with the backside threat again. I call it the backside threat. The backside threat is the Democrats want to raise taxes when we run big spending.
Right.
The Republicans want to lower the taxes when we have surpluses. And there will probably be a strong argument from the Republican side to lower taxes once we start running surpluses. Folks, the surpluses is the only way we pay off debt.
Correct.
So, for a lot of people, the concept of running a surplus is a really bad idea. Give this money back to a good, solid American.
Right.
Folks, we borrowed that money. We should pay down the debt to a reasonable level.
Yeah.
And then start talking about tax cuts.
Yeah. When we're talking about, for instance, George W. Bush, when he took office, we had a surplus. And he lowered taxes because we were projected to continue to have surpluses, even with the lower taxes. And I was very much for this, still am. I think that it was a good move. If we hadn't gotten involved with a couple of wars and done a prescription healthcare benefit without funding, but you throw those three big items out. And I still think it's a good idea if you expect to have a surplus to give some of it back, not tax quite so hard, while paying down the debt. That makes sense to me.
Well,
but what tends to happen in government is you do
irrational things.
Irrational things, and which is you lower the taxes and then you raise the spending.
And the thing is that's exactly what tends to happen when people, I don't know why, and maybe you can figure this out if you're smarter than I am out there. Somebody can explain it to me. When we have tax cuts at the federal level, if you go back and look in history, an amazing thing happens almost immediately after the tax cuts.
What's
Congress
that?
Raises spending.
Right.
Dramatically.
Yeah. That's so normal. Well,
so
when
they,
you think
they,
about
A, they have this extra money so they can spend more money, but at the same time, they're giving the extra money back.
We do it at home, too. When people get a bonus, they pay off their debts and they go out and buy a bunch of stuff. And they wind up with the same debts that they started with.
Right. And when they buy the bunch of stuff, they feel good. It's called the wealth effect. And they borrow too much money on their credit cards and then. It's a really fascinating little syndrome. But the good news is, and I want to emphasize the good news, there's a couple of things here that are very important. One, our tax levels in the United States are, as a percentage of our gross domestic product, the lowest they've been in many decades since we've been a world power. And yet, our deficit is coming down, and it's coming down very nicely. And this is the fascinating thing. The money saved from sequester has almost nothing to do with the decline in the deficit.
Correct.
First off, it hasn't hit full-fledged and won't until the next fiscal year.
Yeah.
Secondly, if you look at the total amount of money that is saved in the sequester, it's a drop in the bucket. It is insignificant. In other words, all are yelling and screaming and upset and pounding on the table and whatever else has gone on in Washington really hasn't resulted in much action, but the deficit came down pretty much by itself. It's kind of like I was listening to NPR, and they were talking about the world birth rate and the great fear 10, 15 years ago that we were going to so overpopulate the planet in such a short period of time that we were just going to starve ourselves out. And so there was a lot of money and a lot of effort and a lot of non-governmental organizations that were working really, really hard to find some way to reduce the birth rate, and they never accomplished anything because they kept running into cultural problems and all of this. And we come 10, 15 years in the future after a great deal of noise and smoke and money and nothing being accomplished. You look around and you find out that the world birth rate is falling very nicely towards stability.
Yes.
Despite the fact that all of their concerns, and it's kind of like, that's kind of the way, by the way, I feel about global warming. It's going to happen, folks.
Yeah. Yesterday in Russia was National Have a Baby Day. Yes.
Did you participate?
No, I didn't.
Oh, but you're not in Russia.
At
least half the population was probably totally left out. Well, yes. I don't know. They probably were willing to encourage that.
What Putin recommended that people stay home from work.
And have a baby?
And practice making babies because their birth rate is so abysmally low in Russia, they're looking at it as a national threat.
You know, eventually he's got to stop being the prime dictator or whatever he's called of Russia.
And again, you know, he's got to stop again, you say.
He's probably building a case to come over here, you know, because he had a op-ed in the New York Times.
Did you read it?
Yeah.
It was actually very well written. It
Until
was,
you get to the end.
Even when you got to the end, it was well written, but it was well written for the Europeans, not for the Americans.
Basically, you guys stay out of this business because you're not humanitarian and you're not really cool, and besides that, you're American exceptionalism.
You're not exceptional.
You're not exceptional.
It's dangerous.
Just go away and don't mess with us in Syria and let us do our thing and behave nicely and do what we tell you to do.
Too much. I realize that weapons used, but knows who had those weapons. Well, we we know.
Well, the people that were being killed were the people who were fighting against the government. That kind of is a suggestion. And the rockets looked like they were fired from government.
Yeah, and they're from government-controlled sites.
Right.
So,
but who really knows?
I think whoever launched the rockets was an idiot. I don't think Assad had a whole lot of input into the decision to launch the rockets.
I hope he did.
If he did, then he's even more dumb than I thought.
Random people using chemical weapons and Hezbollah running around all over the place.
Yes. Well, I think that may have. I think that may have been the case in this particular situation.
Well, the fascinating thing is, if he were to run for president and he would propose
Putin?
National Make a Baby Day.
Yes, I think I would vote for that.
Well, half the population would vote for it, but I think the other half the population might not be quite as excited about the idea of, because only half the population would get pregnant. Less than half.
Oh, yes. Well.
A small portion. And that
small portion.
They probably wouldn't. I don't know if they would go for that.
I don't know. All of that is a kind of a tongue-in-cheek, even though they were fairly serious about it, talking about the demographics of the rest of the world versus, I realize that we're just continuing on the line of Putin saying we're not exceptional, but look at our birth rate.
Yeah, we're
growing. We're growing as a people. Our education rate is increasing. Theirs is decreasing.
By the way, Putin's saying that we're not exceptional, there's nothing unusual about the United States, there's nothing, you guys just stay out of this because there's nothing, you
right.
don't have anything special.
Right.
How many people in the United States are applying for permanent visas to live in Russia?
Well, there was one. It wasn't even permanent there, I guess.
He's
a one-year asylum is what he applied for. Yeah,
he belongs in an asylum, Snowden. But other than Snowden, how many people...
I won't get into that. You say you belong in an asylum. I'm not going to get into that one.
Well, he's got an asylum, so
yeah,
he belongs
there.
Yeah,
he does.
Anyway, I won't go there either. But suffice to say that I think it's fascinating that Putin's arrogance in
Russians are lining up in droves to come and live in the United States.
But we're not exceptional.
No,
that's good to know. That I think we can all agree that Putin is stupid. Never mind.
No, he's actually brilliant. He is performing by saying what he said. He knew who his audience was. That was a brilliant move. He's not stupid at all.
And he published in the New York Times, and the people who read the New York Times probably would agree with him. America is not exceptional, and we should really not be involved in stopping the use of chemical weapons.
Right. If we don't, who does?
Well, apparently, John Carter agrees with Putin.
Evidently.
Anyway.
He voted against
it. We could get in some... Well, not only voted against it, he came and spoke against it.
Yeah.
That's a really fascinating... Talking about unions and Republicans
right,
getting into the same
There
boat.
Are some issues involved. The rebels have a lot of bad guys in them in Syria, and we're getting into a political area. See, the phone lines start lighting up.
We had to say something.
Yeah,
really?
We're getting into a political area, but... There are a lot of really nasty people fighting against the Assad government. There are also some people that aren't so nasty fighting against the Assad government.
I saw a number from the CIA that they published that said about 14 to 16% of the anti-government fighters are Islamic radicals.
Yeah. Well, when you think of, if you go to Egypt, that's about the same ratio. The Islamic Brotherhood only have about 14% of the following, but because nobody else was organized, they're the ones that got elected.
But they got unelected too.
Want to call that.
We have a call on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Morning, Jeff. Morning, Jake.
Good morning.
Was it Putin? Was there comments about Putin that got you to call?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not at all. Well, of course, my feeling about that particular matter is that, when was it, 2 years ago, we had all these people screaming and hollering about, oh, it's so wonderful, the Arab Spring. And the first thing I thought about was a book I read by David Horowitz, published in 2004. And he described in there that, title of the book was Unholy Alliance, and it's about the Muslim Brotherhood working in conjunction with the left in America.
Hmm.
Anyway, I have...
Well, that's... But, you know, it's fascinating. The Muslim Brotherhood is against us attacking Syria.
The Muslim Brotherhood is against anybody who's not a Muslim.
Okay, but they're against us attacking Syria, and so apparently is our congressional representative. That's an interesting, strange bedfellows there.
Well, I'm kind of that way myself.
Really?
My feeling is, as long as we don't know who is where, we shouldn't go in there.
Well, we do know who controls the chemical weapons.
No, there's a good deal going there. If he even gives up a quarter of them in this thing, in the deal that he's made with the Russians, I'll be happy. If he gives up an eighth of them, I will be happy. Mm-hmm. If he gives up any of them at all, I will be happy, because trying to find them without knowing where they are, it is quite likely that a lot of the Iraqi chemical weapons are in Syria now.
Yeah, and
got it exactly
right. And apparently the CIA has a pretty good handle right now on where everything is. But that may change, and since Hezbollah is now involved.
And let me take a step back here and say, caller, do you know which political party Assad is a member of? Most people,
I have no idea.
The political spectrum of the Middle East, it's so complex.
Well, he's an Alawite.
He's an Alawite. That is a it's a tribe.
It's a religion and a party.
The party itself is the Ba'ath Party.
Mm-hmm, right.
And for those of you that don't know what the
Ba'ath Party is.
It's
really clean.
It's very, very clean. The Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein was in the Ba'ath Party.
Right.
Correct.
You know who started the Ba'ath Party?
Yes. Hitler. Not a joke, folks. Hitler started the Ba'ath Party.
Hitler hit the Nazis in the late 1930s, funded the original organization of not only the Ba'ath Party, but the Muslim Brotherhood. And their objective was to start an Arab uprising in the Middle East and distract the British in World War II.
And it worked, except that...
Hitler's gone and the Ba'ath Party's still there.
Right. And the Ba'ath Party exists in the same sort of premises, not premises, but premises, that the Nazi Party did, which is basically, we will have a benevolent dictator that will be the great father and create a great bastion of happiness, and when they have elections, no one will be running against them. That's what's going on. Assad, who was... 30, I think he was 30. He was elected in 2000. He was 35.
Because he was his father's son.
Right.
That's why.
His father was the president before him, and he, as a colonel, who was an eye doctor, and as in the military, and as a colonel, he was in charge of an anti-corruption movement in the government, which coincidentally removed the corrupted people that were planning on running against him in the presidential election.
Right.
Because they were very corrupt people. And so now he's been elected. He's now, 48? And has grown up in an environment where everything he does or says is correct. All of this is, I mean, nobody out there, I think, thinks that Assad is some nice guy, that some great guy.
They don't?
Yeah, he is... at least on the spectrum, better than Saddam Hussein.
No. At some point before the uprising, his propaganda machine worked very well. His wife was showing up in fashion magazines making statements about rights.
Yeah.
He was actually...
John Kerry had a great meal with him just a couple of years ago. He and his wife, and John Kerry and his wife, sat around and had great conversation. And it all comes back to politics again.
Well,
the reality, though, is that if he's using, or anyone is using, the chemical weapons, we need to get that locked down, because he has connections to people that would really like to use those chemical weapons on us.
Caller, you mentioned that you were against us doing anything about it. So this is a question.
Against us going in there.
Not going in there. We weren't going to go in there. We were going to shoot some missiles, smart missiles, to take out certain sites.
I would not even support that.
Okay, this is my question. At what point in the use of chemical weapons against other people, wherever they be, at what point would you support the United States becoming involved to stop the use of chemical weapons?
I don't know, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
Because that's such a mess over there.
So if they used them on us, that's okay too?
Oh, no question.
Well, let me say,
if they use them on us, I'd say atomize them.
Why do you think, you know, chemical weapons have been around since World War One? They were used in World War One.
No.
And the United States made it very, very clear following World War One, don't ever use those again.
If somebody uses them, we're going to flatten you.
And in World War II, they didn't get used. Now, why do you think they didn't get used in World War II?
It's not like we were
happy
people.
We can document why they weren't used in World War II, by the way, because we actually have the records from the people who had them and decided not to use them. And why do you think they haven't been used? Many countries have chemical weapons around the world. Why do you think none of them have hauled them out and used them except on two occasions? Once, obviously,
the Kurds in Saddam Hussein's area.
Saddam Hussein used them.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have been used one more time. There's good documentation as to why they haven't been used.
If you remove the stick, they're going to get used.
And the reason is the political consideration for the use of chemical weapons is that the United States will come in and level anything in sight if you use chemical weapons.
This is right up there with the whole concept of negotiating with terrorists. If you begin the negotiation, it's all over. People will start kidnapping and going at great lengths to make you negotiate further because you've got a habit of doing it. If we don't respond to the use of chemical weapons, then they're going to get used again.
That's the same. You know, it's the same reason that people don't use nuclear weapons. We have told them, Pakistan, you shoot at India. India, you shoot at Pakistan. Anybody uses nuclear weapons, they're going to get nuclear weapons used on them by the United States.
Now
if we take the position of saying it's okay, you can use chemical weapons or nuclear weapons. Okay, no big thing. What do you think the end result will be?
You know, I really didn't call to argue with you.
Okay. Well, I'm curious.
I may or may not.
I'm not arguing. I am asking your opinion.
I've given you all the opinion I've got on the matter.
Okay, got it.
A pretty good one.
I don't claim to know much about the Middle East. I've never been over there.
Well, it's not Middle East. This is my question to anybody, and I would ask the same question to John Carter. At what point, where's the line? The president and the Congress, by the way, Congress had a resolution, says you use chemical weapons, we will attack you. Congress passed that resolution. The president stated that resolution. Now, Congress is saying, oh, no, it's okay. And here's my point. I don't really understand that, and I would really like somebody to explain to me how that makes the world safer or better.
I think if, in this particular case, if Assad really does start giving up chemical weapons, I would prefer that to going in and blowing them up. If he really does it. If he doesn't,
we
need to have some kind of back.
Yeah, I completely agree that if he gives them up, that's fine. But my point, but he ain't. It ain't going to happen.
We have another call waiting
for
us.
All right, thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call.
All right. And you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Bruce. I have a 401k, and when the sky was falling back in January in my mind, I transferred that all into mutual fund bonds, and now I regret that.
Wouldn't it
be a good time to
come
back in the regular mutual fund market?
You want to handle this one, or you?
That is a very
the question itself
complex question.
Well, no, it's a very simple question.
It is.
Yeah, I'm going to make this simple.
You make it simple.
The simple thing is that's the wrong question.
Ah.
The simple thing is you moved in January because you didn't think it was the right time to be in the stock market, and you're looking for the right time to be in the stock market. Now, you know where I'm going with that.
Yeah, you got it. Market timer.
Yeah, market timing is suicide. Anybody that does it regularly recognizes that you get it right. If you are really, really, really good, you get it right about 51% of the time. The rest of the time, you lose money.
That's if you're a professional.
That is the absolute best.
There was actually a study, several studies I've read, where market timers have been tracked. I also tracked one personally for many years.
Dalbar does a great study on this.
And a very sophisticated one who happened to be trading through us, so I allowed him to do the trades through us.
So that we could track
his
return.
So I could see what he was doing, because he's really good. He really had all the sophisticated stuff, and he did terribly. And he thought he was doing well, by the way, every time I talked to him.
But when you compare it to the return of the market...
He actually lost money during long periods of time when the market was rising. The issue is, I think, very important, and that is you look at your long-term objective, and you look at your long-term comfort level with the market, and you find, particularly if you're in a 401k, you're going to have a limited number of choices. If you're not particularly sophisticated, there is probably somewhere in the middle range.
Before we continue that, when we say not particularly sophisticated, we're not talking about your intelligence level.
You're not a sophisticated investor.
A legal definition for the word sophisticated when it comes to investing,
and that is okay.
So we're not claiming that you are not sophisticated in other areas.
And there's probably a model that your 401k company provides that will fit you. And I suggest you just get on that model and stay there.
So is tomorrow as good a time as next week?
Well, tomorrow's Sunday.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to get
Monday.
The trade done on Sunday.
Yeah.
But, what we talk about when we talk about long-term investing, if you believe that the economy of the United States is going to stop growing forever and it's just going to shrink from now on, then you should be out of the stock market.
You should be out of the country.
Right. However, if you have a long-term view of the United States that says that it's going to be a little bit better over time for a long time, then that's where you need to be. When people try to make short-term decisions with long-term investments, they run into problems. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about that last hour, but it's a very clear thing. If you are trying to get to Las Vegas, say, in a car, and you're running short on time, so you just skip buying gas. You're making long-term decisions with a short-term deal here.
And
so
this is my warning to you, though. There's a tendency, if you got out because you were afraid, to think, I've lost time, I've lost opportunity, I'm going to get really, really aggressive now. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Get in the middle, look at the kind of reasonable return, and for example, in the bond side of the market, you're not going to get any return.
Right.
In the stock side of the market, you can look at historic numbers, and you can probably make a pretty good guess at like anybody else on what's happening. So your division between stocks and bonds will result in a return.
Yeah.
And if you're right in the middle of the road, by the way, the stock market's long-term return is around 8%. Somewhere between 8 and 10 for the long term. Bonds, you can go ahead and say, and by the way, Jeff McClure's opinion, and I'm just giving you a general opinion here.
Totally in concurrence with this. Totally agree.
Use really short-term bonds.
Yeah.
And conservative allocation funds and things like that. Stay away from longer-term bonds.
If you're going to be in bonds, then do very short-term.
And just recognize that you've got a preservation side to keep you comfortable from which you will need to draw when you retire. And you've got an aggressive side that's going to, probably have a tendency to make you some pretty good money over a really long period of time, and also probably going to take another nosedive one of these days that will just scare the pants off of you.
Yeah.
But you've got to ride through the nosedive.
You don't want to be in a public situation when your pants get scared off. It's very embarrassing.
Well, as I said, it's regrettable.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
I appreciate the advice.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thanks.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I tuned in late. Have you guys talked about the budget showdown that's coming up at the end of the month?
Only lightly, in passing. There's going to be some more volatility in the market.
I don't know.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, Syria seems to be getting all the press and stuff, but you know, based on what I'm reading, it's going to.
It could be.
Again.
it could get really, really ugly, but everybody from Karl Rove to every other Republican strategist had said, has been warning the Republicans. This is what Karl Rove published in an interview. He said, President Obama is baiting the right, the conservative Republicans in the House to shut the government down.
He wants that.
He wants that.
If they do it, then he's got ammunition for the rest of his term.
I know they don't like Karl Rove too much right now, but I'm saying if they do that, if this is just my opinion, and it's just a matter of how bright you think the people are who are on the right wing in the House of Representatives, if they have a smidgen of intelligence, they will not knock the stock market down 16% like they did in 2011. They will not take it to the edge. They will find it compromised, and they will find it early. If they don't, they are giving 8 more years to a Democratic president.
Yeah, and I'm going to say this. This is something that could get me in a lot of trouble.
Oh, everything you say gets you in a lot of trouble.
I like Karl Rove a lot. I think he thinks in a way that is long-term. I think his motivations are very different from a lot of other people. He's got different goals. But the way that he thinks, the way he approaches it, is very strategic. And when he's talking about...
Strategery,
yes. Right. When we're talking about the budget, this isn't just about making a deal about whether or not the Affordable Care Act gets reformed or whether or not we get a good budget in place. We're talking about a presidential election. We're talking about possibly 8 years of power shifts. If we as a people get caught up in the short-term mentality of the individual small goals of whether or not this budget has that or this budget has this, if the people involved there on the Republican side and on the Democratic side don't take a look at what their long-term results need to be, then they're going to make some really, really silly decisions based on whether or not people think it's really popular right now. That's you know, it's the same thing we were just talking about with bonds and with equity. Long-term decision-making needs to be very clear, and the budget debates that are going on right now could have very long-term consequences if they're not really, really careful.
I understand that, and, you know, it's all about politics and blaming one another, and midterm elections are coming up. And I know you guys have addressed the U.S. debt versus the world debt, and we're not in that bad of shape. But, the deficit is a real hot button for a lot of people.
Agreed.
And if they, you know, this is another kick the can thing down the road, and when are those clowns going to wake up and address it? Or is this...
Actually, it's fixing itself. No. Yeah. It's fixing. It's what we were talking about earlier. You weren't, as you said, you just turned in. The Congressional Budget Office, the Treasury, and the Office of Management Budget all agree on something which is really scary. And that is that this fiscal year, which ends this month, will have the lowest deficit since 2008.
Now, that isn't because of sequester so much as other things.
Sequester's had virtually no effect on this. But the deficit, the annual deficit of the United States from 2009 through now 2013, has dropped by 50%. And it shows every sign of continuing to drop. As a matter of fact, everybody is now, all the offices in Washington are now projecting a surplus in September.
For the month.
Just for the month. But admittedly, we weren't having any surpluses a few years ago in any months. And
isn't that kind of like paying the minimums on a credit card?
Well, no, not in this case. What's happened is if you found that let's put it like this. If you suddenly got a pay cut of 50%, and so your family is now spending a lot more than they're making, and you got to borrow money to make up the difference, and over a several-year period, you gradually wind down your spending, and you get increases in your revenue at the same time, in your pay at the same time, and you see that if you just keep on the track you're on, in about 5 years, you're going to be seriously paying off your debt. that probably would work pretty well for you, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's where we are in the United States right now.
No, we did talk about this just about half an hour ago, about the government has a propensity when revenues start getting good to raise spending and to
cut taxes.
And we don't need to do that now. We need to pay off the debt when we get surpluses.
Right. Once we get a surplus, which around, and I'm going to say this, I don't know this. Obviously, there's a lot of unknowns in the future. But sometime in the next 10 years, probably about 5 years from now, we could conceivably have a surplus. And there's going to be a powerful move at that point, again, to cut taxes and to increase spending. And by the way, the last time we had a surplus in 2000, we cut taxes twice and increased spending dramatically. I mean, two wars off the books and the prescription drug plan, and you just add those three things together, and to be surprised that we suddenly are spending more than we're making.
Now, in the process here, there's a lot of other things that have to happen. Obviously, we've got to reform Social Security and Medicare. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how we treat the other aspects of the budget, it will be underwater. We will not be able to stick our head above water to breathe. We've got to reform those things. We're talking about 15 or 20 years from now, and we're in a lot of trouble, and we need to make the decisions today. But all of that, that was really long-winded for what do you think is going on with the budget stuff today.
Well, I know you're coming up against the noon hour. Can I ask another quick question?
Real quick, because we got to play some commercials between then and now, too.
There was something, I think, last week in the Wall Street Journal where 13 economists are saying you need to the budget office and everybody needs to get together and recognize unfunded mandates. Have you guys talked about that yet?
We haven't, but that is absolutely true.
We talked about it
a little bit last week.
But it's been around a long time, and it is a serious problem, and I don't frankly know how to address it.
Well, I know how to address it, but the reality is that it's not going to get addressed the way that I would do it. The way I would do it is very much like the concept of the balanced or the balanced budget amendments or the, and I don't mean to the Constitution, I mean moving towards a balanced budget, moving towards funding the things that you say you're going to pay for. The whole concept of sequester is one that I find repugnant. The idea that Congress approved a budget, went ahead and hired the people to do the things, to spend the money that Congress said to go and do, and then said, no, we're not going to pay for it. That's not how you do it. What you do is you build a budget correctly. You say, this is how much we think that is appropriate and healthy for the government to be spending, and then you stick to it. And that's something I realize that makes me a strange person to actually think that we should stick to a budget and make a budget that actually makes sense, but I'll be that strange person.
Okay. Well, I enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Late. Next time I'll call about line item B.
All right. Sounds great. Good stuff.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We do have to play some commercials, and we're probably going to play some long commercials. We'll be back for a little bit on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake McClure.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, this is this is Eric Brown here in Temple.
Hello,
this
Eric
is a comment
Brown.
On earlier you were discussing Putin's editorial. I read an interesting article this morning on The Spectator which pointed out that the three main points that Putin was arguing have been key points of criticizing America that the left has been doing for 40 years.
You'd almost think the guy used to be a communist or something.
Yeah, you'd think that somehow he was involved KGB or something.
He was amused by many progressive-type people today in various places in our culture being upset by what Putin said. And
it's the idea that
they really, if a Republican was in office, they would be saying the same things.
Right. It's the idea that every kid on the soccer team gets a trophy. and
right.
and you know, everybody's exceptional. It doesn't matter if you have a star player or not. You know, everybody is exceptional. And so
if the extreme left hates what Obama's doing and the extreme right hates what Obama's doing,
he might be doing something correct.
He may be on the right track. Who knows?
Okay, anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. It was kind of like the pot calling the kettle black there.
Yeah, yes. Well, only we need to watch that.
Yeah,
we
don't, we yeah. Don't, yeah, we when, don't, when, yeah. When the head of a country not known for its human rights is saying that the United States has horrible human rights, there may be a little hypocrisy somewhere in there. You know, just a little.
Yeah.
Nah.
Absolutely. Okay. Anyway, thanks. Great show today.
Thanks for calling.
Take care, guys.
Okay. And you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach
with
Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We didn't get to say that because I wanted to get to the phone call. We're almost out of time, so I don't think we're going to take any more calls. But I did want to thank you for listening. If you've been listening. Oh, we got one more call. Should we take it?
You said you were not going to take any, and now
let's contradict myself.
Let's waffle.
Okay, you're on the air with The Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
Quick note, I know you're not going to have time to discuss it much, but when you were talking about the chemical weapons usage, didn't the United States kind of turn a blind eye to Iraq using chemical weapons on Iran?
We invaded them.
Yeah, but we invaded them later. We did turn a blind eye on it. There's no doubt of that, and we shouldn't have.
And we've determined that was a really bad idea.
If you think of the foreign policy of the United States, the State Department's role in all of this going back many years, it's been very consistent. We can't allow that to happen anymore. And we're almost out of time. Thanks for the call. We need to probably talk about that more next week. But if you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at 947-1111 or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You may email us at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts and so on.
So until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach. Be safe out there. Have a good time investing, and we'll be back next week.